a couple weeks ago, we talked to you about kind of church finances and stuff. We don't talk about money a lot here, but we talked about we're coming to the end of our budget year, and we're looking at this week, beginning tomorrow. Emily, who leads our resource team, and I will be building the budget for next year. And we just came to you all and said, here's the truth, is we have to trim $30,000 from next year's budget. And in order, the only place to do that is to really look at moving out of this building or severely cutting our staffing hours and those kinds of like big, like make you sick, make you stay awake at night decisions. And so we decided at that point, we ought to come to you as a church and just tell you that because that seems important. And really, in 9.5 years of churching together, we haven't ever really come to you, I don't think, and said like, hey, we need people to think sacrificially about this church. And so, in fact, somebody told me, you know, when I first came here, you all didn't talk a lot about money, so I just assumed you had lots of cash laying around. Which is not what we're trying to convey, but oops. What we've been doing over the last couple weeks is we've been inviting people to come up and talk about why this church matters to them. And so, and I see lots of new faces this morning. So this is a nice thing. So this is my friend Karen. Karen and I have known each other for 25 years now. Is that right? Yeah, I went to high school with her daughters. They were a little bit older than me and a little bit younger than me. Yeah. And little Charlie. I did not date your daughters.
No.
My brother did, yeah, right. My brother did, yes, which took Amber off the table for me because that's weird. And then we went to church together for a long time, and one of our favorite people ever is the same person, our pastor.
Yep.
I say my pastor, but so he was our pastor.
Yep.
Karen leads a group here at the church called the Hot Mess Sisters, and I've been invited. I've been to the Hot Mess Sisters.
You're official.
I am official. I like the Hot Mess Sisters. So, thanks. Karen serves on our leadership team. And here's what I want you to know about Karen, because she won't say it about herself, is you're retired.
Yep.
And you live on a fixed income.
Yep.
And so I know all the time your heart is you would love to give millions to this church, but not possible. But I know these are all things you've said in groups of people.
Said, yeah.
So what we've just been asking people to do is tell us why this church matters to you, and I'll stop talking.
Okay, sounds good. You know, when Charlie first messaged me, I think it was like Thursday or something, he said, would you mind just talking about why this church matters? And I thought, oh, sure, that's simple. And I really didn't think about it too much more. It was a busy week, you know, and so last night, as I got ready to go to bed, I thought, oh, I got to talk about why this church matters. And so the first thing that came to mind was it was all self-centered. You know, I'll admit that. This is my spiritual home. I think of it like a home, a family. And this is where I come to get nurtured. It's where I come to get, uplifted a little bit, filled up a little bit on the word, on the mission of Christ, all those things. And so that's the first thing that came to mind. But you know what? It's more than that. Another thing is, this is where my friends are. You know, I'd like to take every one of you out for a cup of coffee. I really would. I mean, when I come into a gathering of Imago people, whether it's here or anywhere else, I always kind of breathe an internal sigh of relief, and I think, like, you know, my people. And I don't say that in a tribal sense. I mean, we're all quite different. Okay, we all think a lot of different thoughts. We have different lifestyles and all that, but we have a couple things in common. I guess we're all on. We can all admit that we're on a journey towards spiritual formation. We're not there. Is anybody here there? You know, I'm not there yet. Okay, but we're all on this journey. And here, what I love about it is that it's okay to be right where I am, even if I am a hot mess. And it's okay for all of you to be wherever you are. It's exactly where you're supposed to be. And I love that feeling here, that it's okay to be where you are and who you are. But then it's more than that. Again, I just had to make a couple notes because I didn't want to forget. I just think that always, always here, just like we sang in that song, if it's us or them, it's us for them. We are encouraged when we leave this building to not forget that. we're encouraged, we're built up, we are edified so that we can leave this building and we don't have to just go into our own little homes and sit there with big fat heads of spiritual knowledge. I like that a lot. I like that encouragement. And, you know, I think of this church as a church of open doors. You know, I was thinking in my mind last night about how they're like swinging doors, the front doors, the back doors, the side doors. They open both and open both ways. Some churches you go to, at least in my experience, has been that you come in, you get all filled up, and then you quietly kind of go out the back door and slink on home and shut your own door. Here, that's not very much encouraged at all. We're really encouraged to get out there and be the Imago Dei where we live, with the people that we interact with. And all of that, for me, that is so important. And I guess for me, I can't give a lot of money. That's why I give a lot of time, as much as I can. And you can do that, too. If you don't have a lot of money to give, get involved. Give the gifts that God has given you. I mean, money's good. If he's giving you money, feel free to, you know. It's good, because we keep the lights on. It's important. It's nice to have a place. It is good to have a place, but we aren't a place. We are a family. We're the family of Imago Dei. And I guess I would just close by saying that for me, I think the open doors that swing both way, they're really the reason that I always feel like this place is a breath of fresh air.
Thank you. That was really well said. So most of you, if you're in our database, you got an email from me 2 weeks ago, and I said this 2 weeks ago, but I'll just, this is the last time I'm going to say it for a while, is basically we're trying to raise about $30,000 for next year's budget, which comes out to about $2,500 a month, which comes out to about $15 a month per every man, woman, and child in the place. And so what we're asking you is if you can look at your giving again, and we're asking you if you can think through at least that as a template for, hey, if everybody in my family could give $15 more a month, or some of you I know that's just not possible to do, and that's okay. What can you do? And then for some of you, $15 a month is like, I spend that in coffee, so that's not a problem. I can do more. So we're just asking you to do that. We created these pledge cards that you can fill out. Here's the deal, is we need them back today, because tomorrow we start building the budget on whatever we have, or whatever the giving is. So if you could drop those in the offering box at the end, I'll give you a reminder. If some of you have already started doing this, you can go fill there's a form online you can fill out. And some of you have just gone in and you've told us, hey, I went in and changed my giving on the recurring giving. If you did that, please fill out a card too so that we know that happens. Otherwise, we have to go through all the giving records and see everybody that changed, and it's not exactly possible to do that very well. So even if you've already done it, please fill out a card. If you're going to do it, fill out a card. Please drop us all the cards today and we start budgeting tomorrow. That's the last we'll talk about money for a while. Okay? Turn your Bibles to John chapter 18. Let's get into John. We are coming quickly to the end of John. And let's start by talking about Mad Max. So a couple years ago, this movie came out. I don't know if you've seen it. I was watching it on a plane, and it's like really loud and really intense movie and a lot of fun. What's interesting about this movie is there is something like 2,000 special effects in this movie. There, every minute of this movie, there's 12.5 special effects. And I couldn't find the number for how many scene changes there are, but there's a ton. How many of you have seen this, right? Like at least half of us, right? And the filmmaker has made choices in the cinematography, like that he said in an interview, like where scenes had too much information for the eye to gather in, he slowed down the film rate so you could take it in. And in scenes where the action was a little slow, he sped it up. So like maximum, you are exhausted after watching this. Somebody told me the other day, there's a Harvard study, neuroscience study about learning that says if you're really focused on learning for 7 minutes, all parts of your brain are firing, and it's the equivalent of running a 5K. So after a movie like this, it's like, oh, just done. So when I thought of this movie, because there's so many jumps, but every movie's like that, right? Every movie, they said in this movie, there was like somewhere around 400 hours of raw footage. It took them 3 weeks just to watch all the raw footage. And a movie is what? 120 minutes long? 100 minutes long? That's the way it is. I don't know how many of you write, but when you write, they say, I heard Rob Bell say a couple years ago about the sermon, the best sermons, you can, well, he said it's about movies. They say you can tell the quality of the movie by what's on the editing room floor. And the same thing about a sermon. It's often a sign. If I'm using every last thing I've got, I probably haven't prepared enough. It's usually when I have to cut out things I really want to say that it's like, oh, now we're cooking with gas, right? Like, now we're honing this thing. That's what editing does. So John tells us in John 21, which we haven't gotten to yet, the very last thing he says in this gospel is this. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have enough room in the books that would be written. So what John is telling us is that he had a ton of Jesus stories to tell. There were so many more things I could have said about Jesus, but I made choices. I chose to tell you some things and I chose not to tell you others. And so one of the most interesting things to me, especially when we study the Gospels, is asking that question, like, well, John, why did you tell us this detail? And why did Matthew not tell us that? And why did Luke say this thing? And then John said something that seems to disagree with Luke and probably did disagree with it. Why did he make that choice? And so that's what we do. We study and see all the ways it conflicts and changes. Like, oh, okay. So Rob Bell just wrote a book called something. What is the Bible? There it is. And he says this. He's asking the question, what's the most important question to ask when you study the Bible? And he says this, why did people find this important to write down? Start there. There are lots of other questions you can ask, and many of them can be very illuminating, but start with this one. Why did people feel the need to write about this? It's really interesting, like even reading Hebrew scriptures. Why did they think it was important to tell the story about a guy being swallowed by a fish? So that we had good Sunday school material? Probably not, right? They had a reason for telling these stories about themselves. Why did they tell us a story about God and Satan gambling over this guy's life, so let's make him sick? Why was that important? And so that's what he's saying, is we should ask those questions. So when we get to this section of John, that's part of what we want to do. Why is John telling the story in this way? When we read this passage in just a minute, and we're going to read part of 18 today, I'll show you what we're going to do in just a second. You're going to see it, and it's not quite as fast moving. The scenes don't change quite as fast as Mad Max Fury Road. But there's definitely this sense that John is doing like, look here, look at this thing, now look at this thing. Oh, go back to that thing, and then look at this thing. And he's moving us to look at certain things in the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, which is what these couple chapters are about. What we're going to do this week is see how he does that. It breaks down into like three sections, roughly. The first section, John's going to take us to Jesus' Jewish trial and then really talk to us about Judas and Peter. And we're going to see how both of them failed Jesus, all right? And then next week, we're going to do this thing. It's fascinating. And it's this brilliant piece of editing where John starts this section on all the Roman trials that Jesus faced. And he keeps saying like, outside, this was happening, and then they moved inside, and then they moved outside, and then they were back inside, and it just goes back and forth the whole time, and John is doing something similar to what he's doing with light and dark and in and out and all these things, and we'll get to that next week, and then in a couple weeks, we'll talk about the crucifixion and burial. So for now, let's go to John chapter 18, and we're just going to read it together, and we're just going to hit the first 27 verses here this morning, and then we're going to discuss. So let me, just a second. John 18, when he had finished praying, Jesus left his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied, "I am he." Remember in John, by the way, we keep getting these I am statements. I am the light of the world. I am all those. I am the vine. This is another one of those ego am I in Greek. Ego am I, I'm he, Jesus said. And Judas, the traitor, was standing there with them. When Jesus said, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, he asked them, who is it that you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they replied, and Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go. So this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave to me. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. You can cross-reference that to chapter 11 if you're into that. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you? She asked Peter. He replied, I am not. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter was also standing with them, warming himself. Meanwhile, back over here, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why do you strike me? Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself. So they asked him, you aren't one of his disciples too, are you? And he denied it, saying, I am not. One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him. Didn't I see you with him in the garden? Again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, a rooster began to crow. We're going to pause there because then the next line is, then they took him to the Roman governor, and I was telling you, we'll get to the Roman trials next week. So what stands out, what seems significant or important or of substance to you? So a contrast between Jesus, who's very like, everything I've said publicly, and Peter like, oh yeah, I don't even know the guy. And the other gospels tell us that he even denied him with curses. I'll leave you to your own imaginations. I could do that, but children. Oh, I love that. Yes, Jesus says, I am he, and Peter says, I am not. I didn't caught that. That's good. I love that. He says, I am he, and it's a Benny Hinn moment where everybody just like falls to the floor. Yeah, that's a weird one. You feel bad for Peter, consumed by fear. Yeah. They fall back because for sure John is hoping that we catch back to Exodus 3 where Moses asks God his name and God says, I am who I am. That I think John is wanting us to make that connection back there for sure. Yeah, so here's how I think of it. So my brother-in-law was telling us about his kids, and they're like 4 or 5, and they're playing soccer. And he says, if you've ever watched little kids play soccer, it's just this little scrum following the ball around the field. And he says his little boys, they always want to be close to the action, but they don't actually want to kick the ball. Right? Like, you can think of little kids doing this. Like, I want to be close. I want to be in the, I'm in the action. I'm in it. But they don't actually want it. Like, if they actually got to the ball, they'd be terrified. Like, what do I do with it? A little bit like that, right? Like, Peter somehow wants to be close to Jesus and close to what's happening, but he doesn't have the courage or whatever it is to actually own it. Like, yeah, I'm one of his disciples. So he's close, but like living in that middle space. Can we pause for just a minute? How often in our spiritual lives do we live in that space right there? I so want to follow Jesus, but that's scary. So we hang in that middle space, not fully out, but not fully in either. That's rich. Yeah. So a couple minutes before that, ear goes off. Yeah, that's a really poignant moment where Peter lops off his ear and everybody expects, like, here's the revolution. And we're going to talk about that more with Judas in a bit. Here's the revolution. And Jesus responds with, put away your sword. This isn't what we do. Again, this is, I don't know what to do with this, by the way. It's interesting that John leaves out the detail that Jesus healed the man's ear. The other gospel writers tell us that Jesus healed the ear, and John just kind of like leaves Malchus without an ear eternally. It's just interesting. I don't know what to do with it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, he highlights the injustice of being slapped and then challenges it. Which is a really, that's another talk for another time, but in the turn the other cheek stuff, the idea of that passage is really not about passivity. It's not just lay down and take abuse, but it's about highlighting the injustice in a nonviolent way. How do I highlight how do I turn a light on this piece of darkness? Yeah. Yeah, so in the early one, he tells them to pack swords. And then when they lop off the air, it's really confusing, right? Interesting. So here's what I think John is getting at in these passages. If I had to pick a big idea for these 27 verses, here's the big idea that I would play with. And this mostly is stealing from N.T. Wright. Okay, it's 100% stealing from N.T. Wright and putting it in my own words, which is also known as plagiarism. The whole human race, Jewish leaders, Romans, and even errant disciples. Even errant disciples array themselves against Jesus in these 27 verses. It's like what John is trying to say to us is that everybody puts Jesus on the cross. Everybody has a part to play. And we have to point out, you know, can I just say one little thing? Like, the only person who doesn't is the person who's telling this particular story. And I find him so self-righteous. It's just annoying to me. As reading the passage and studying this, I was really annoyed this week with John's self-righteousness. Like, all the other disciples left Jesus except this one that I know. And that's how he keeps saying it, like, the beloved disciple, the one that Jesus really loves, stayed with him the whole time. I'm just saying. That's maybe he didn't write it in a smug way. Someday maybe I'll find out. But I just think there's a lot of smug happening and kind of, ugh. All right, so let me unpack this just briefly. If you think about what I just said there about the Jewish leaders, the Romans, and even the errant disciples, I think it breaks down into these. It's a whole religious system that's arrayed against Jesus. What the Jews are doing, this is one of my pet peeves, is when people, especially contemporary modern Christians, start talking about Jews back then, and they paint them in these really like ridiculous, like, well, they just didn't love the truth. Do you really know somebody like that? That's like, I just hate anything that's true. I hate it, right? People think that what they believe is true. That's why they believe it, all right? But what they believed they were doing when it came to how they interacted with Jesus, they were doing it out of religious fidelity. They were being faithful to everything they understood about God. And that put Jesus on the cross. And feel the contradiction in that. And it's easy these days to pick on the Romans, the political systems. I mean, we're going to get to that next week. We're going to talk about Jesus and Rome and some of those things and how he challenged Rome. It's easy to do that one. But then John is also making this other point that it's also about my personal choices. It's about the choice of Judas to do what Judas did. It's about the choice of Peter to deny Jesus in the way that Peter denied Jesus. So if you in this room come from a more liberal persuasion, either politically or theologically, we on the liberal side love to talk about religious and political systems. The whole system is wrong. We need to fix the whole system. And if you in this room come from a more conservative side, either politically or theologically, we on this side like to talk about people's individual choices. People have responsibilities, right? Have you ever heard this conversation go back and forth? And it's ridiculous because what John is saying is, what's at fault? The big systems or the individual choices? Yes. Let me just say a little side note. Any answer to our political milieu that only talks about the individual and not the system, or only about the system and not individual choices, is only talking about half the problem. What John is saying is it's both. All of those, religion and politics and personal, all array themselves against Jesus at the cross. I said that on Good Friday, I believe. There's a good quote from N.T. Wright that I spent a half hour looking for, and then I was like, psh, I'll just plagiarize it. All right. So here's what I want to do this morning is I want to set aside the religious system just for the morning. I told you way back when we started John that John has been accused down through the centuries of being anti-Semitic at times because he seems to have a lot of venom towards the Jewish leaders. And I feel like in my own background, we've mined that quite a bit about the Jewish leaders and their conflicts with Jesus. What I want to do this morning for a little bit here is I want to go down to the level of Judas and Peter. I want to talk about the sins of Judas and the sins of Peter. It's interesting to me that I just really, gut level, when I say Judas, what do you feel? What do you think right off the top of your head? Traitor, betrayal, sad. When I say Peter, what do you think? Fear. You said fear earlier, yeah. He's the rock. That has a totally new connotation for us, yeah. What else? Impulsive. It's funny that I think when we just reflexively think about those two people, if I had a choice and I said, hey, y'all, next week I can get Peter or Judas here to speak, who do we want to speak? Peter. Actually, I want Judas. So much more interesting. Like, I have so many questions, right? So let's dig in just for a minute. Here's what I want to do with most of our time left this morning is I want to ask you to look at your Bible and start reading there and tell me what Judas did wrong. Or tell me how you think about Judas. And let me tell you where the inspiration for this came from. On Tuesday, I had a meeting with some pastor friends and got stood up. And so two of us showed up. And so I was sitting with my friend who's a pastor and we had an hour that we had scheduled. And so we just started talking. And we started talking about, like, because this is what pastors do. What are you preaching on Sunday? And so we were talking and I started talking about this. And then we got into this long riff about Judas and textual criticism and blah, blah, blah. But he told me about this book. And this book is called, it's not even a book. It's not even a screenplay. It's a play called The People versus Judas Iscariot. Has anybody ever seen this performed or heard of this? So it's done typically in liturgical churches during Lent. And it's a 5-act play. And what happens is, and so in liturgical churches, they usually preach for about 15-minute homily. And so in that context, you would have your normal morning thing. And then what we would have done if we were going to do this over the next 5 weeks is there would have been a table up here and there would have been a judge. And there would have been two tables down here for the defense and the, I was going to say the offense. Prosecution, thank you. And what we would have done is put Judas on trial. So the play is the trial of Judas Iscariot. And the idea behind this is Judas has already admitted his own guilt. Like, yeah, I did it. And it's our job, it's your job as the jury to decide on his punishment. Eternal damnation, or does he get forgiveness? And so over 5 weeks, the defense and the prosecution call their witnesses. They call John and Peter and Mary Magdalene and Paul, and eventually they call death. And so, and I can't, maybe there's a couple others. But they call their witnesses and say, like, what do you say? And then the cool thing about this play is it's open-ended. So the last thing that happens in this play after the fifth week is we hand out cards and you vote. Like, what do we do with Judas? And so that was part of what I wanted to do to set this up this morning is I want to talk about what is Judas's sin? How do we think about Judas? And then we're going to turn it to Peter and talk about Peter's sin. And we've got about 9 minutes to do all that. So you better start talking fast like somebody else I know. Oh, let's go back to Judas's sin. Let's stay on Judas for now. What's Judas's sin? How do we think about Judas? Yeah, so two things that Danny points out. First of all, I want to point out something you didn't quite say. I said it when we were there. Is at the Last Supper, who did Jesus serve Last Supper to? Judas. Judas is included in the Last Supper, and isn't until after that that Judas goes to do what he has to do. And then there is this, clearly Judas has a high level of remorse about what he did. And then he did something to himself. The gospel writers disagree with each other. Right. Somebody told me this week, this might help. Somebody told me this week, I can't remember who it was. Was it maybe you? That they knew somebody that went to Israel or somebody that, okay, maybe nobody in this room. They knew somebody that went to Israel and the Mount of Olives is just kind of this hillside. And they said at Passover in that day, the hillside would have been covered in tents. So think about like Lollapalooza, so dating myself, but think about like a music festival, like, okay, Woodstock for some of you. Think about, come on. You got it. And so this idea of like, there would have been like lots of tents packed in there. And so finding Jesus might have not been as simple as, hey, he's on the top of that hill over there. Like, we picture it as kind of by himself, as we think garden and we think secluded, but at Passover time, maybe not secluded, maybe tons and tons of people around. And so this picture of lanterns and clubs coming in the night is very Gestapo feeling. It's very Nazis coming to round up the Jews kind of feeling, and Judas is leading them through the masses of the maze of tents to get to the one where Jesus is at. So that's at least one idea. That's often the thought, yes, that they came at night so as not to cause a scene among the crowds, to not cause any more disruption than it would cause. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I think it's important.
Right. Yeah, sure. Jesus kept disappearing in crowds when they tried to do it other times. Let me give you two other ideas. My friend Bill, who I was talking to, who gave me the book, the play, he his theory... And this holds up. There's other people that interpret it this way. When Jesus says in one of the Gospels, I can't remember which one, it's not John, I don't think, but he says, whatever you do, do it quickly, and sends Judas off, that what Judas did was exactly what Jesus told him to do. That Jesus said, I need somebody to lead the authorities to me, and Judas, this is the role that you're going to play, and I need you to go do this task for me. And that Judas's remorse isn't so much about guilt over what he did because he was faithful, but rather his remorse was over, I had to play a role that was really... Have you ever had to do that? Have you ever had to play a role where I don't actually want to be that person, but I have to be that person right now? You know, like the parenting 101, I don't want to be the person that's the heavy. I want to be the fun parent all the time. But sometimes we have to take turns, right? Like, sometimes we, plug all your ears, sometimes we really have a conversation about, all right, who's going to take this one, and who's going to be good cop, who's going to be bad cop here, right? Sometimes we have to play a role, and his theory is that Judas is simply playing a role that Jesus asked him to play. I'll ruin the play for you. Here's another idea, is that Judas actually acts out of a place of deep fidelity. We know that Judas is a zealot. Do you know what zealots believed? Zealots believed in that if they rose up against Rome, if the Jews could just muster an army together and rise up against Rome, then God would be on their side and they would drive out the Romans like they did back with the Hasmoneans and the Maccabees a generation or two before. And so in the play, how it's presented is that Judas's motives, and it's a whole other line of thought, is that Judas's motives were that he really believed that Jesus was the Messiah. And as such, because he really believed that Jesus was the Messiah, he believed that Jesus couldn't die, and that what this thing was is that he thought that if he could bring this to a head, it would force Jesus to stop being so peaceful and nice and to pull out the swords and kick some Roman butt. And that his suicide afterwards was his disappointment that he got it so wrong. That, oh, what have I done? I thought I was acting in the best interest of my people. I thought I was acting in the best interest of Jesus. I thought I was going to be the one to push him to be everything that I actually believe that he is. And then it didn't work out that way. So believe what you will about Judas. Maybe some of you this morning walk away like, nope, he is the ultimate betrayer. But he's a betrayer that was loved by Jesus. Let me say real one, two, I'm going to say another thing, maybe more. It's interesting how the play presents it. Like, let's pretend that Judas had at least like 1 ounce of remorse. Did he have as much remorse as the thief on the cross? Or think about the soldiers at the foot of the cross where Jesus says what about the soldiers? Remember what he says? Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing right now, and they're forgiven. And the play tries to make, the defense actually makes the case. If there's forgiveness for the thief, if there's forgiveness for the Romans, why can't there be forgiveness for Judas as well? Because it opens up this idea, if we say that Judas is eternally damned, then which of my sins is going to get me disqualified forever and ever, amen? Like, what, so there are some sins? Now, most of us don't get the chance to hand over Jesus to the Romans. That's a sin that had a very one-time, you know, like fairly obscure. they probably put it in the rules somewhere because it happened, but. So flip it a little bit. That's actually kind of the easier one. Think about Peter's sin for just a moment. Tell me about the mechanics of Peter's sin. How does this one work? And how do we think about it? Oh, that's such a great way to say that. Seth just said, it's much more passive than active. It's easy for us to wag our fingers at Judas, right? Because it's so, like, well, he did that. And Peter's is so passive. And in fact, one commentator said, even in the first denial, who does he deny it to? He denies it to the girl at the gate, a young girl at the gate. And he said, like, you could almost think that Peter didn't even think of that one as an actual lie. It's like when my kids said, did you eat ice cream last night? And we like, we minimize it because it's just lying to the kids. It doesn't actually count, right? It does. And the bowl in the sink kind of gave it away, right? But that's the idea. Like, if I lie to, like, it's just a little girl who's asking. So when Jesus, like, sometimes we think of Peter like Jesus told him before the cock crows three times. We almost, like, we see it as, like, Peter denied him. There's strike one, right? Like, we see it that way, and we think that Peter was doing that. And the commentator said, to the passivity, like, I doubt even Peter noticed it. He didn't even think of that one as a lie. It just was so passive, so easy to, like, this girl doesn't even count. And the one to Malchus's relative, well, of course you're going to lie to the relative because the relative esteemed that you cut off his cousin's ear. Understandably so. So you're obviously going to lie there. So that's just like almost like you could justify every one of those as a legitimate reason to not be fully truthful. It's very, very passive. Can I be honest? Very, very relatable, right? Like, it's hard to identify maybe with Judas. Like, again, most of us don't have the opportunity to betray the Son of Man. But man, the sins of Peter, so much more in my wheelhouse. So much more passive and, well, I didn't mean that, and I didn't do that. Anybody else? One or two more, then we'll wrap up. Vicky. Okay, let me say this back, and then I'll try to think about it. Judas manipulated the system. He's working with the Jewish leaders. Peter manipulated his own self-awareness. You have to say more about that. Oh, so Peter's betraying himself. What Vicky's saying is Peter's betraying himself. It's his own lack of self-awareness in the moment that is really his sin. It's his own awareness of what I'm doing that catches up to him later. Can we just wrap it up there? Have we ever found ourselves in a position where it's only later that we realize that we've sinned against someone in some way? But I did this thing and this thing and this thing, and I didn't realize how that hurt that person. I didn't realize. If you haven't had that moment, you ought to talk to your spouse. Just saying, you've done it. Oh, I didn't realize when I did X, Y, and Z that hurt you. I didn't realize when I didn't do this and this that I was sinning against you. I think for me, that what this passage, and the reason I wanted to spend a couple minutes playing with this Peter and Judas idea, is that we can get on our high horse about political systems and religious systems, and next week we're going to get on our high horse about political systems a little bit because we're going to talk about Jesus in Rome. But really, the hard part about that list of all the Jewish leaders and the Romans and the errant disciples, the ones I relate with the most, are the errant disciples. Those are my people. Those are the ways in which I sin against you, and I sin against my kids and my spouse, and sometimes it's a betrayal. Yeah, sometimes I put the knife in and twist it, sure. More often, my sin looks like Peter's, and it's subtle, and it comes out of like, I didn't even realize in that moment when I did that. We sing this song here, it's become a popular modern hymn called How Deep the Father's Love for Us. And it's the one great line in that song. It's the best line in the song. It was my sin that held him there. And I think sometimes in religious context, we sing that and we just kind of sing it like that's what we're supposed to say. But I think in a very real way, when Jesus died on the cross, it really was the Jewish leaders and the Romans, and it was my sin that held him there as well. It's my sin that holds me in bondage still. It's the things that I do consciously, maybe like Judas, or unconsciously like Peter. And part of this spiritual journey is growing in our own awareness of the ways in which we do that. That's why we talk about things like the examine and practices like that, because they help me become more aware of when I do that thing, I'm sinning too. I'm leading to problems. I'm leading to relational discord. I don't even like that word. Disharmony. And so let's pray together and invite the Holy Spirit into that space. For sure, God, there's times where we play the Judas. For sure, there's times where we know what we're doing and we do it anyway. For sure, we can name those spaces as well. There's times, God, where we've been the victim of that, where we know people have made choices to hurt us, and we know both sides of that coin all too well. But probably more often, we find ourselves in positions like Peter, where the rooster has now crowed three times and we realize, oh my God, what have I done? And we confess those to you. It's so easy, especially in those, to justify and rationalize and explain away. And we want, in our own spiritual journeys, we want to stand before you and own it and just say, yep, it's even my unintentional sins that put Jesus on the cross. It's even my own lack of awareness that causes me to sin against brothers and sisters. And so help us to grow. Help us, that song we sang earlier, that the light will grow within us, that we'll begin to see more of who we are and how we live. God, help us to take that to our workplace tomorrow morning, to our families this afternoon, to the spaces that we inhabit the rest of this week. Help us to grow in our awareness of how we reflect the light. In your name I pray. Amen.